This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we get a rare opportunity to examine the hidden contents of Jefferson County's historical treasure chest. It's a place you probably don't know about and can't even visit without pre-approval. And now we go inside the Compass. Hidden in the trees off Airport Cutoff Road is a magical place you may not know about. It's close to the Secret Gardens Nursery, and you've probably driven past it thousands of times. You might have even noticed the little sign, Jefferson County History and Genealogy Research Center. And it truly is a magical place for anyone with an interest in the rich history of this county and its little Victorian seaport. Underneath that sign is another that simply says, "Welcome." But that's just a bit misleading. Visitors must make arrangements in advance if they want to poke around inside this building known in some circles as Jefferson County's treasure chest. On the 137th birthday of the Jefferson County Historical Society, for just a few hours, this treasure chest was open to the public for free guided tours. Outside the building, we spoke with Bill Tennant, Executive Director of the Jefferson County Historical Society, and we were surprised that the welcome sign comes with limitations. Your so-called treasure chest.
Yes.
Is that not normally open to the public, only open to researchers?
Yeah, the storage facility that you went through, which is, yes, it's definitely a treasure chest. It's full of our county's treasures. The public doesn't wander through that the way you would in a museum. But if you're a researcher and you've got some reason to see particular artifacts, for instance, you're studying Native American tools, well, our collections manager would retrieve the stone tools that we have in the collection, bring them out to you in the reading room so that you could examine them. Or she might make a place for you in the facility where you could do research. So you can actually have the written documents that talk about something. For instance, you want to design a costume for a high school play that takes place in the 1920s. Well, you can look at actual costumes, clothing from the 20s, actual pieces of clothing, or you can look at patterns, for instance, paper patterns that we have in our collection. So whatever it is you're studying, there are written documents and also three-dimensional items that might help you with your research. That's why we call this whole place the research center. Mm-hmm. So even if you're dealing with three-dimensional items, it's all part of the research. And that's why we keep things. That's why museums collect things. That's why we continue to collect things. You know, we don't know what's going to be of interest to people 100 years from now.
So let's go inside the treasure chest with our guide, Becky Shurman, collections manager for the Jefferson County Historical Society.
So I always love to show people this. These chests are full of tools that belonged to Horace Tucker, who came here in about 1862, and he built the Rothschild House, the McCurdy House, the Episcopalian Church, the Pink House. And I've been told that you didn't need a resume when you showed up with trunks like this. I mean, it just spoke to the fact that you were really going to be able to do the job. And actually, this attaches to these two pieces. So you have a 10-foot-long workbench mm-hmm. with all your tools inside. We had an exhibit about these tools. I mean, because they're amazing. And I took some of the planes out and sent them to the wood school mm-hmm. at the fort and asked him to make some profiles so we could sort of illustrate what they did. And he said they were all absolutely dead sharp. It was mm-hmm. just amazing. Had absolutely no trouble producing, you know. Yeah, and I think there's at least 130 planes in here, and you could produce everything that was needed, you know, windows, all the molding, all the doors, it's all there, so.
How come you quit?
Well, it was hard work. He went into business, you know, he actually went into business, he lived until he was 99, but he opened up, he
Well, it was machinery. They started, you know, getting shapers. Yeah. So a lot of this work was done by machine. He opened a brick factory. So he actually produced a lot of the bricks that you see in the buildings downtown.
So again, we just have all kinds of, you know, cool, old things. Totally fun project we did. One of the first things we did was unpack hats that had been in boxes for
at least
10 years.
Oh,
yes.
Gorgeous.
And wow. It was so exciting that the two volunteers that were working on this said, we have to have an exhibit. So we did. we put hats and portraits on exhibit.
Do you have any sense of the value of any particular object?
Some we've actually had assessed. We've done that work.
The reason I ask is I was curious what the most valuable object you might have here in your entire collection, whether it's in a museum or in any of the five locations. Any clue?
I do. I'm not sure.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, you know, I think that the James Swan's cane that was carved by Charlie Edensaw probably is one of the rarest and most valuable things. We've got some really, really valuable things in this collection. We had that valued because we sent it to Canada for an exhibit up there of Edensaw's work.
Mm-hmm.
So
yep.
I know it's worth quite a bit of money.
Can you give us a ballpark of what it's...
No.
Okay.
I can't.
Okay.
Yeah.
Executive Director Bill Tennant gave us an idea of the size and scope of the Research Center's treasure chest. And we snuck in that question about the most valuable object again.
Okay, well, it was estimated actually by a previous director here who was doing an inventory that we had 500,000 historical documents. And as we unpack and properly house all of the artifacts, we're thinking we have somewhere between 30 and 50,000 actual artifacts, three-dimensional items, and probably that same number of photographs.
What is the most valuable item you have, if there is such a thing?
Well, I don't know. How do you put a price on your great-grandmother's photograph? We don't get things appraised. We do know that James Swan's cane is quite valuable. Yeah.
We heard about that, and that you had to get it appraised because it was going on to Canada for display?
It was borrowed by the Vancouver Art Gallery, which is the provincial art museum for the province, and they borrowed it for an exhibit on Charles Edensaw.
And is the appraised value a state secret?
It's probably not a good idea to put out. Let's just say it's very valuable.
It's very valuable.
Yeah, it's a very valuable piece.
Okay,
yeah. but everything is valuable to us.
Yes.
What did Becky tell you?
She said she can't tell me. So I thought perhaps she was.
Well, she was correct. She's the boss.
So we asked the boss, Becky Shurman, a bit about her own background. You're a Port Townsend native, been here a long time?
No, I came here 35 years ago and bought a house and realized if I didn't go back to school, I was going to be in trouble. So I did go back to school. And in the process of getting through that, I started working for museums and got completely hooked. That was about 35 years ago.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. I got hired as a framing carpenter for the Oregon Historical Society for this big long-term exhibit. And I ended up getting to deal with actual artifacts and design cases. And I went, oh, well, that's it. I know what I'm going to be doing.
This is where it's at.
Yeah, I'm not going to get rich, but I'm going to be pretty happy. So, yeah, I've been doing this work for a pretty long time.
That's great.
And I really like it a lot. Yeah.
Back on the Secret Insiders Tour, Becky showed us some delicate antique women's hand fans and lots of vintage art. And she also talked about the mission of the Jefferson County Historical Society.
We've also been working on, this has been very fun, we've been working on the fan collection. And this one has polyester tops because we're having a little trouble with our floor covering, or our sealer is failing a little bit. Makes this nasty dust. So we're finding that we need to make lids for anything that's going to be difficult to clean. So this has been great fun. I was working with one of the volunteers, and she said, oh, there's writing on the back of this fan. I said, oh, no. And she said, it's, we started looking at it in a very light pencil. This came from the Willison family. It was Eva Willison, who was a famous violinist, and these were some of her fans. And what she'd done was write the gowns that were appropriate to wear with each fan. I know. I mean, how... it's just, like, amazing.
If you have artwork and you want... and you donate it, does it just end up here stacked up in little piles, or what good is it?
Well, okay. Our mission is to save things for the future. So, in a sense, that's exactly what happens. It gets here, we take care of it. We can't possibly put everything we have on exhibit, but we do have changing exhibits, and when it's appropriate to an exhibit, it goes into the museum or one of our sites. Not so much that, but the museum exhibits. But, yeah, we take care of it, and it's here. Your family wants to come see it. They can do that, researchers. But we don't, as you can see, it wouldn't be possible to put everything we've got.
No, I already saw that.
Yeah.
I just was curious how it worked, because I have quite a bit of art mm-hmm. and from local artists, and uh-huh. I like it. I don't want it stored in a garage somewhere, so
right.
I have to figure out how to keep it visible.
We have almost 50% of our exhibit space is in the courtroom is art exhibits, art and history. So every 6 months, we change that out and put something else in. So we draw from the community, we do loans, and we do things out of the collection as well. So a lot of our art actually gets into exhibits. And since I've been doing the exhibits there, I always try to include art in all the history stuff too, because I mean, I think that's just a real important part of what, you know, what we do and what we have in our collection. So, you know, I feel confident that what we have, you know, isn't on exhibit every day, every year, but it does have its time out in the public.
So people get a chance to appreciate it
yes.
at some point.
You know, the other issue with that, I think, is it's a conservation issue, too. You don't want things on exhibit for 10 years. I mean, if it's a porcelain pot, it could, but a quilt really shouldn't be on exhibit more than 3 months tops. It's the same thing. We make those kind of judgments about pastels and watercolors, and you bring them back and give them a rest before you put them on exhibit again.
And the reason would be what? Light would damage
light. It? Yep, it's light damage. And to be perfectly honest, we don't have humidity controls at the museum, so we're going to have fluctuating humidity levels in the museum space again. That's not really good for stuff. Limited periods of time, and we make those judgments. Can this, you know, really withstand a 6 months exhibit period? Is it going to be okay or not? And we have a conservator who's on our board who volunteers, who helps us, you know, make those kind of decisions.
Director Bill Tennant briefed us on the history of his organization, as well as how this research center, known as the Treasure Chest, came to be.
The Historical Society was founded in 1879. And in 1951, it moved into the City Hall downtown because there was some vacant space there, and the city asked the society to come and put some exhibits in there. It was the centennial, Port Townsend's centennial in 1951. So there's been a museum in City Hall since 1951. But when the building was restored, starting in 2003, we had to move our archives out, and we needed a new place, a place for the archives. And we thought we'd have to buy property, we'd have to get an architect, we'd have to design a building. But this building came on the market, and it was a church. And we were having a meeting, actually, of the building committee, and two of them were realtors. And they said, well, there's a building that just came on the market. Maybe it would work for you. And so they actually got up from that meeting downtown, drove out here, looked at the building, and you know, basically a church is a big open space. So they said, wow, yes, this, you know, this would work for us. And two of them who were board members, they said, you know, if the Historical Society decides not to buy this building, we'll buy it and we'll get some kind of agreement with the Historical Society to occupy it. But the Society did decide it was a good deal to buy it and purchase it. All of our board members chipped in. They said for 30 months, they would each chip in and pay the mortgage. But within about 6 months, we got an amazing donation through the Seattle Foundation of $200,000, and that's what this building cost. So the building, from the beginning, the building was paid for, and And that money that the board members were chipping in, we continued to save that. And that gave us some seed funding for the new wing next door. Because we thought that this building, well, this will just last us forever, you know. And within about 2 years, it was full. It was full. And all of the collections that you just saw over there were stored, you probably heard, they were in basements, they were in attics, they were in abandoned bunkers. You know, we did the best we could to take care of them, but we needed one place where everything could be together. So we started the capital campaign to build the new wing. We had some grander plans for it, but, you know, the reality reared its head, and we built a facility which I believe it, you, there is probably no other county of our size that has a facility like this. So we're quite proud of it. So that's the story of this building.
Back on the treasure chest tour, Becky surprised us by lifting the covering off a very large mountain lion, complete with snarling fangs.
Oh my goodness.
That we call Dusty.
Appropriately.
It was taken around here someplace?
It was. It was shot in the Olympic National Forest before it was a national forest. And it actually sat in a window of a store in down on Water Street for years and years. And we had it in the museum offices for a while, and then some staff got kind of concerned, because early days, what museums and collections people did is they sprinkled this kind of stuff with arsenic to cut down on the bugs. And so we haven't seen any evidence of arsenic, but we just don't want to take the chance. Registrars 100 years ago didn't live very long. One of the things that, for me, in dealing with collections that's interesting is we're setting stricter parameters about what we collect. In the very early days, I think folks just took whatever was on offer. And now we really try to limit what we're taking to what has to do with the history of Jefferson County. If something comes to us that's really wonderful and it really should go to another county or another museum, rather than have it end up in Goodwill or something like that, we try to direct potential donors to another museum that would really, it would be more appropriate for it to be there.
Always drawn towards superlatives, the biggest, the rarest, the most valuable, we return to Executive Director Bill Tennant.
You know what the oldest object is that you would have here?
Well, interestingly enough, I mean, a woman in North Beach, when we were doing the Native American exhibit, just coincidentally discovered a piece in her garden that we've had appraised at or assessed at being between 4,000 and 10,000 years old.
What is it exactly?
It's an axe, or it's a hand axe. It looks like a big, so it looks like sort of like a big arrowhead.
Wow.
That was found in her garden. And so the Jamestown Sklallam cultural, their anthropologist who works for the Jamestown Sklallam is the one who looked at it and appraised it. And apparently about 4,000 years ago, give or take a few hundred years, the style of axe heads changed. So that's how he can tell that it's between 4,000 and 10,000 years old. So that might be the oldest thing.
Directing the Historical Society feels like a calling to Bill Tennant.
You know, I think from when I was a child, I enjoyed visiting historical sites and kind of imagining what it was like for people who lived there, and telling the stories of the people who lived in places, different places, and that's what we do at the Historical Society, and we tell those stories through the objects that they've left behind, and the words that they've written, or the words we've been able to record, or the photographs that they have left behind. So me personally, I like the idea that something that I do today might have an impact on someone 100 years from now. Someone asked me that once, what was my most memorable moment. I think it's when I actually was able to stand in front of a bulldozer and stop an important historic site from being bulldozed. And I know now that site is safe and will be available for people in the future to learn something about the people who lived on that site 100 years ago.
Did you get arrested for your action? Or at least
no,
or anything?
No, but the policy on that particular site was changed, and it was actually an irrigation ditch is what it was that served a ranch out in a remote area of Utah. And it was an important physical memory of what had taken place on that ranch. And so to bulldoze it, to build a road, would have eliminated that piece of evidence of occupation there in earlier years. So it's still there now.
Is this a profession for you or a volunteer job?
No, I'm paid by the Historical Society. That's why I came to Port Townsend.
Before you were doing this, what were you doing?
I was doing nothing before I was doing this.
You've been doing this your whole career.
Well, my actual full-time paid professional job in museums started in 1991. I worked for 10 years at the Museum of Western Colorado.
Oh, okay.
And then I worked for 9 years on an island in the Caribbean. At the National Museum of the Cayman Islands. And then I worked for 2 years at a historic home in Savannah. And I've been here now 13 years. So this is the longest I've been in any one place.
And you like it here?
I can't imagine why anyone would not want to live here.
For Becky Shurman, the true magic of her so-called treasure chest comes from the stories behind the artifacts in the museum. History comes alive for her when she can connect dusty photographs or relics with a compelling human drama. She told us one such story that ranks among her favorite.
A Native American carver from Nia Bay, mm-hmm. who came down with some things that he wanted us to look at to take on loan to be a part of this new exhibit we have up. There had been some difficulty in kind of getting in touch with those folks, and I was very nervous. As the person who does exhibits, we weren't going to have enough on our walls. So I had already gone ahead and selected a bunch of what I thought were really strong images out of our photo collection to be turned into rather large banners. And one of them was a Native man in front of a kind of slab house carving a mask. And it was, you know, what, 36 by 24? I mean, I had all those printed. So Bill Martin came here, we met, we talked, and we spent a couple hours. He just told me stories. And at some point, he sent his son out to the van to get some photographs that he wanted me to look at. The son brought them in and put them on my desk, and it was the same image that we had selected for a banner. And Bill said, "This is my grandfather. His name is John Smith." And so already we know something about an unidentified photograph in our collection. He proceeded to tell me that when smallpox hit Nia Bay, almost everyone died. And the man who took care of the lighthouse had gone in a boat to see if everyone was dead. And he found this infant suckling at his dead mother's breast. So he picked the child up and took it home with him and raised him. And he was one of the few survivors. At some point, they were fishing. Traditionally, we always think of the tribes as being in real specific locations, but that's not true. They travel all up and down. And they were fishing down in the Hood's Canal. And another fisherman saw John in the boat with his adoptive parents. And he said, "I know who you are. You're..." And said his macaw name. And sure enough, I mean, so he actually left his adopted parents and went back to Nia Bay and lived with his tribe and became a really well-known carver. In fact, he was so good that he sent a piece or was requested to do a piece for Queen Victoria. And in one of the photographs, he's wearing a little gold, you know, award that he got from her because his piece was so beautiful. So here is this image that we just had in our collection that I was drawn to because it's a very strong image. We have a conversation with someone, and all of a sudden we have all this. We have his macaw name, all this history. So, again, this is the really juicy stuff. So, it happens every time we do an exhibit. We start, you know, talking to people and finding things out, and it just gets richer and richer. Yeah. And it's pretty cool.
Tennant concluded with a roundup of all the key facts about the Jefferson County Historical Society.
It's a nonprofit organization, and we are supported by memberships. So we encourage everybody who is interested in preserving the history of Jefferson County to become a member of the Historical Society. A lot of people think we're a government agency because county is in our name and that we're funded by Jefferson County, but that's not actually the case. So we do depend on memberships. The basic membership is $50, and our membership includes everyone in your family. So grandparents, parents, and grandkids all get in for the same membership. And that allows you into all of the museums for free as often as you care to come. And also free walking tours of uptown and downtown, invitations to members-only events and exhibit openings, and discount, 10% discount in our wonderful museum shop.
And collections manager Becky Shurman summed up her own special connection to history.
For me, what makes things really amazing are the kind of stories that come with them. You know, it's like that story about the Willison violinist penciling notes on her fan to indicate what gowns went with what fan. I mean, you discover things like that, and it just gives me chills.
At the Jefferson County History and Genealogy Research Center, sometimes known as the Treasure Chest, I'm David Cunningham for KPTZ News. This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by David Cunningham. The Compass airs Mondays and Saturdays at noon, Tuesdays at 5 p.m., and Wednesdays at 10 a.m., exclusively here on KPTZ, the home of eclectic, authentic community radio. For the news team here at KPTZ, I'm David Cunningham.